not problems of curriculum, not problems of education, but matters that go to the very core of our destiny as human beings. The things that affect our everyday life, but in a very profound way. At every critical step we take in life, there can be two different versions, two different visions, one practical and the other spiritual. Let me give you an example. You don't feel well. You're ailing, you're coughing, and the cough lasts a long time. What do? Whom do you go to see? I should hope so. You go to see a doctor. Not only that, but you make sure that the insurance covers him too. It's included in your insurance. And you look for the best doctor you can. You want only the finest medical attention because it's your body and your life that's at stake. And then, what else do? You make sure that the rabbi mentions you in his tefillah, and you say that in your shemoneser, you mention yidosem v'fanecha shetishlach rafua shleima so-and-so, and you have the mishabera said publicly for yourself, and everyone wishes you a rafua shleima. What's going on here? If you're going to a doctor, who needs the tefillah? And if you have the tefillah and you rely upon God, who needs a doctor? Now that's now it sounds a little bit unreal, but there was a time in Jewish life that this became a serious theological problem. How would you define it? This way. If you have faith in God, then you know that if you're sick, he wants you to be sick. And if you're going to be healed, because he wants you to be healed, then why go to the doctors? In the Middle Ages, the answer that was given to this question, and it's a serious question, theologically it's a serious question, was given because the Torah says, in a case of injury, and in the laws of Torah, from the Zikin, the Torah says, "Varapo yarape, he shall pay his doctor's bills." So mikan nitna reshus l'rofe l'rapos. Well, here we learn that the doctor is allowed to practice his healing arts. Otherwise, what right does, if anyone here is a medical doctor or an Orthodox Jew, the question is, how dare you? You're interfering with God's activity in the world. He wanted this person to be sick. How dare you cure him? But the answer is, the Torah said no. You believe in God, but you must cure him. How do you reconcile these two visions? On the one, the practical way of going to a doctor and finding the heal and being healed by medicine, and the other one by saying to God, God, and we will be healed, and the doctor is in your hands as well as the patient. It's up to you, God. Please heal us. If you think about it clearly, there's a real conflict between the two. And the question is, if one, why the other? The same problem came up, I must tell you, much closer to our time, 200 years ago, approximately, maybe a little less, with one of the greatest of the Hasidic teachers, one of the most mysterious ones, Reb Nachman Bratslava. Have you heard of Bratslava Hasidim? Bratslava Hasidim, to this day, they go en masse to the Ukraine, to Uman, to the grave of the Bratslava Rebbe. He was one Rebbe, had no followers, and to this day, there are thousands of people who are his Hasidim. He absolutely had a thing about doctors, against them. He was against them. He felt that going to a doctor was a sign of lack of faith. It was an action of impiety. If you were pious, if you were faithful, you did not go to doctors because you prayed to God and God will heal. So how do you get these two visions together? In the Middle Ages, the High Middle Ages, there was a great, great commentator, a great writer called Rabbeinu Bachya ben Pakuda, Bachya some call them, if you don't know the exact pronunciation. And he stresses that there are two things that confront each other. One is called bitachon, or bitochen. What does that mean? Faith, in the sense of reliance upon God. And the other is hishtadlus, making human effort, the human effort in life. So the human effort in life means to do things in order to better yourself, protect yourself. Bitochen means to rely upon God. The question here, too, is can you have only bitochen? Without a shtadlis, no. If only we talk about a shtadlis, you should never take out life insurance. You shouldn't go to work. And just say, God will help me. Can you have shtadlis without bitochen? Not if you're religious. You must have faith as well. Again, how do they complement each other? How do they work? The answer is, paradoxically, these are two simultaneous narratives. Both have to coexist. And even if they seem to contradict each other, so what? There are many paradoxes in religion, and this too is a paradox. So you have three choices. Corresponding to Torah only, you would have, and I'm saying that there are people who say this today, but corresponding to the Torah only, you would have bitachon. Do away with all outside help, with work, with doctors, with dentists, anyone. Everything is faith. The one that's only mada would say, forget about prayer. Forget about faith. They're irrelevant. It's only the practicalities of life, how you go about living a healthy, decent life. Then you have Torah mada, which says we got them both, and we have them simultaneously. Let me give you a marvelous thing. It'll take me only a few minutes to show you a case of Torah only in the sense of bitachon. And this comes from an article that appeared in Haaretz, not my favorite newspaper, the most secular newspaper in the world. It happened on August 28th of last year, 2003. That was the time, the day after, suicide bombers came to the very pious section of Jerusalem, to the Mea Shearim, and the bomb exploded into one or two buses. And it did horrendous damage. Here is a writer, a secularist writer, an agnostic or an atheist, who reports. He spoke about the attitude towards the, I'm reading some sections of this, towards the ultra-Orthodox and their strength in times of distress. I've been thinking about it since the bus exploded in Jerusalem. It was packed with Haredim. Most of the casualties were Haredim or their children. If this type of tragedy had happened to secular Israelis, to Messianic Jews, to Mizrahi Jews, their cries of grief would have immediately sought out the guilty parties, the government, the bus company, the lack of security guards, and of course, the usual cries of Mavet la'Arabim, death to the Arabs. But the Ashkenazi Haredim do not hold anyone to blame. With a sort of nobility devoid of pathos, they live in a world that lies outside of history, in which the blessed be he, God, loves the Jewish people, and whatever befalls a person is God's handiwork. God instructed his chosen people to fulfill his commandments and do what is good in his eyes. He does not need to explain what this good is. The Haredim do not believe that calamities occur at random. The believer ascribes himself to God and lives within the Torah. When I saw how they stood and prayed over their own blood with terrible grief and restrained horror, begging God to forgive them, I can only be envious that my forefathers were like them. When I said Kaddish of my father's rag-bound corpse as it was plunged into the earth, I was compelled to praise and extol God in Aramaic, no less. I hated every moment. I felt contempt for my forefathers. But in the eyes of my forefathers, my hate would have been perceived as misreading by a distorted mind. Interesting. We have no God in heaven. We are Israelis. We have so many televisions. We have the cars we drive. We have the general human culture that we are part of and is part of us. The Haredim are not involved in this. They are not interested in Immanuel Kant or Bach or Beethoven or the question of how much a pair of Reeboks costs. When the tragedy hits them, they seek to understand within their hearts through prayer what evil might have been committed by those who have never sinned. How could an 11-month-old child be guilty of anything? But their strength to withstand curses, terror, and calamities is a strength that we, with all our teachings, do not know. We disparage them, but they pity us. The moments after the tragedy in Jerusalem made me realize something I had not fully appreciated. And it would not hurt us to try to understand the nature of their elegant and pained stance at a time when the soul cries out for vengeance. The word vengeance does not exist in their lexicon, with the exception of a few sentences like, Shvach HaMoschal HaGoyim, pour out your nation, your fury upon the Goyim, which none of them takes very seriously. After all, the Haredim never killed Goyim or Jews, but the others did. I find this to be a remarkable testament to the purity of the soul of the Haredi world and how they can read the narrative of emunah and bitachon, of faith, without relying upon anything else. But then I ask myself, is that the only reaction we should have? If it is, if after every tragedy of a bus bombing, we only said, God, I know I must have sinned. I must have sinned. I'm guilty. Forgive me. And try not to understand, but just to bow our heads in beautiful compliance with the divine edict. What's going to happen the next time we catch we know there's going to be a suicide bomber? Do we not do something special? There has to be a practical way of dealing with it as well. The answer is there should be. But you have to live one with the other. You've got to know how to bow your head in submission to the divine, and you have to know how to protect yourself and your children, your city, and your country as well. So, if I were to summarize the whole thing and ask you one last question. Is there a biblical precedent for this ability to have two narratives at once? The Torah narrative, the Mada narrative, the faith narrative, and the practical narrative. The answer is yes. Anyone want to take a guess at what it is? That's it. The Joseph narrative, Joseph story. Yosef and his brothers. If you read the Torah until the very end, you see it's a story, a fascinating story. I mean, we read it every year, and every year, although we know the solution, we read it with tremendous suspense. It's just like, it's a beautiful adult story. And we see how the actors in the story do things, not because of any divine reason, but because they're living out their real lives, real lives. But at the end, we suddenly discover something. What do we discover? Joseph tells his brothers, you know, we got it all wrong. You had it wrong and I had it wrong. You had it wrong when you sold me down the river. You had it wrong when you tried to come in and ingratiate yourself with the viceroy of Egypt. I had it wrong when I blamed you in my heart for what you did to me, for selling me, and I gave you a tough time all along. We're all wrong. Because while we went through this, you know, in a material sense, but God had his plans. And as the Medrash says beautifully, Shvatim hayu oskim b'michirato shel Yosef, God says. The tribes, the brothers, were busy selling Joseph. Joseph osik b'sakov v'taniso. Joseph was in depression when he saw his brothers. Reuven was osik was deep in regret and paralyzed by regret. Yaakov Avinu, the father, was regretful. Yehuda was busy finding a wife. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, hayu osik borei oro shel melech HaMashiach. He was busy creating the light of Mashiach. Because the end of the whole story, after the whole drama of Jewish history is played out, and played out in secular terms, then we discover that all of it leads to the divine purpose of life, and divine purpose for the people of Israel, and that is Arosh HaMashiach. The practical conclusion of all this is, if you feel you need it, get a good doctor, also pray, and above all, stay healthy. You want to have any questions?
Due to time constraints, we're not going to have questions on this particular session. I'm just going to give you, in a nutshell, the schedule. We're going to be eating lunch downstairs right now for about 30 to 40 minutes, and then around, say, 1:30, 1:40, we're going to be coming back up here to Davin Mincha. So the schedule's going to get pushed off about 5 or 10 minutes. At approximately 1:50 or so, downstairs, myself, as well as Rabbis Lamb, Cardozo, Dunner, and Ryman, will be on a panel discussing all sorts of issues relating to the future of Judaism. And upstairs here, there'll be a panel on women in Jewish law with Rabbi Michael Broyd and Ms. Bracha Ruttner. And for the rest, you can check your schedules. And I thank you again for coming. I hope to see you all again.
If I can just ask all the speakers to stay upstairs for 1 minute while we eat lunch. It's downstairs. We'll see you in a few minutes.
No.
2 minutes. Rebecca.